Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we've got a special episode for you. We'll be talking to Bill Eberle from Novanessis. But first, with me today, as usual, is Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. All right, so joining us today on the podcast is Bill Eberle, friend of the show, friend of Todd and myself. He's been involved in large-scale commercial dairying in Wisconsin for more than 20 years and is now an account manager for Novanessis. He has written 8 articles for Hordes Dairymen and has spoken hundreds or two hundreds of farmers on the topic of farm management. So welcome, Bill.
Hello there, guys. Appreciate you having me back again. Always enjoy this very much.
Oh, we appreciate you taking the time to sit with us, and we probably recorded an entire podcast's worth of catching up before we actually recorded the podcast.
But good topics, yes. Yeah.
Most of which we cannot talk about. No.
97%, yes.
So what's new? What's cooking in the workshop these days?
Workshop is as busy as ever, building a curved front nightstand for my beautiful wife.
Nice.
It is time to be done with this project. Let me just tell you, it's time to be done. There's no square edges to measure or mount it's time to be done. It's time to be done.
So for the curved edge, did you use like a flexible plywood? Did you use a steam box?
Very good question. I went around and around, like, how do I do this? Because my wife is like, can you build this? She's like, it's all, and I've never said no.
This is like a picture from Pinterest.
Yep. Yes. Antique store in Arizona. Yeah. That's beautiful. Can you make something like that as a nightstand? Like, you don't say, like, I refuse to say no. Like, I'm not going to say no. Like, sure. Yeah. And then, so lots of YouTube videos. So I use plywood, standard, nice plywood from Menards, but you cut kerfs in it. Every 3/4 inch, you cut a kerf, not all the way through it. So if it's 3/4 plywood, you cut it. Almost, like, leave an eighth, and then that allows you to bend it. And it did go snap a couple times, so it wasn't perfect. It's not perfect, but it's done.
Sure,
but yeah, it was a good learning experience. It's one of those, like, I wish my first one isn't going to go in my house. Like,
yeah, you could try it and then go back and like, okay, now I know what I'm doing. I'm gonna
make a better one.
Yep.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's time to. But the hardest thing again is, like, there's no square corner. Like, how do you? It's an oval. It's half of an oval. So how do you make sure that everything's symmetric when there's no square corner?
Geometry.
Yeah. It's back to geometry.
Which way does it curve? In or out?
It curves. Yeah, in. So in other words, it's half of an oval.
Yeah.
And then the sides open up. So I had to make doors.
Cool. So is it meant primarily for, like, jewelry hanging inside type, that kind of type?
Yeah. So it's got 3 drawers, and of course the drawers have to be, the front of the drawer is curved.
Right.
Yeah. Which, like, how do you then make a square box to mount to a curved front, and then the sides are curved doors that open? How do you, but whatever. Again, Melissa is like, well, you welcome the challenge, don't you? I'm like, I do in theory. It's when it's 5:30 in the morning and I want to throw things in the shop because I can't figure out how to do this or that. But yeah, it's been a good brain teaser.
It amazes me how hard. So next to our bed is an antique curved nightstand that I inherited from my grandmother.
Cool.
And it's cool looking, but I never would have thought of at all of the how hard that was to build at the time and how they would have done it.
I could have built 5 square end tables.
In the time.
Ten square end tables in the time it's taken me to. But yeah, it's now you, yeah. Yeah, it's, I don't, it's like, this is just the, respectfully, like, it's the wrong day to ask me how it's going. Like, if you were, like, I am ready to be done. Like I, last night when something snapped on some of the trim, I'm like, I'm going to pick this up. I am going to throw this out the back door and light it on fire. So it's funny, like, the day, how's it going in the shop, Bill? Like, you pick the one day to be like,
it's going fine. Thank you for asking.
That is exactly what. Yes.
So. You're the pyramid builder getting whipped by the
That's
the master. Yes. Like, thank you, sir. May I have another?
It's time, and I am. I think it's Melissa will start sanding and painting it here tomorrow. And then trying to do the whatever. I turned the feet on a lathe and trying to figure out how to cut flutes in something that's round and heavy.
Sure.
Yeah. It's been a very good learning experience. I'll chalk it up to that. And when it's done, it'll be great. And I'll look at it. But, like, yeah, it's...
What is the hardest thing you've ever built? Is this it?
Yes. Bar none.
Wow.
Bar none.
All right.
Yeah. Bar none. No question about it.
Well, that's why I asked him about the curve, because there are a few different ways to skin that cat. And so the steam box, that's, you know, you're basically slowly introducing a curve. It takes a long time. The method that Bill used, they actually do make a pre-cut type of plywood that it's very expensive. I used it once.
Really?
For a, yeah.
Okay.
So totally sideways story that's going to go nowhere, but I worked for a community theater the last couple of years at high school building sets and that,
oh, cool.
That
okay. kind
of stuff. And we worked at Lawrence University in okay. Appleton, and the guy who ran Lawrence's theater program was like always around. He wasn't like necessarily involved. We were using his space. The company I worked for was renting that space, but he was nice enough to, you know, give us tips and help and that kind of stuff. And he had some of this plywood that was is that what it's called? A kerf?
Yep. That's just bendable plywood.
Yeah.
What you're talking about. Yeah. It's just bendable plywood.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Then you could curve it around things. And so
what I should have done.
Yeah.
I should have used that instead of. Yeah.
But yeah. So that's why I was just curious. Because
I've officially met another person in the ag industry who would get references from Broadway musicals.
Yes.
I thought I was the only one, only because in high school we come from a musical town and the whole damn, everybody in the high school would be part of the production. So like sure. The fact that I can still remember lines from, you know, Brigadoon in Oklahoma. Like I was figured I'd be like the only person in the dairy industry who would.
Matt would be your guy. Yeah.
He would be your guy. Here's the other person.
He would be your guy.
When the winds come sweeping down the plains. Yes,
oh,
exactly.
Oklahoma.
See what I mean? Yes. That's Granted, they did reference that in Twister, didn't they? They were singing part of that.
Yes, like, they did.
Yeah. My wife was a little mortified when I like started singing the rest of the song. She's like, God, you're a nerd. But yes. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get that. I often get looks from my wife like, why do you know that?
Yeah.
What possible use for that knowledge do you have? Like none. Absolutely none.
None. Yes.
When I go to bar trivia, I have a good chance at maybe scoring some points.
Yep.
But,
Bill, you're also talking to a fellow woodworker who is, Matt is currently, Fair Week is coming up, and so he's currently in process of probably teaching young children how to...
Not cut their fingers off?
Yes. Do their woodworking projects.
Wow.
In time for the fair, which
is both my kids are taking some woodworking things to the fair. So
very cool, very cool.
Nothing as complicated as a
curved
front nightstand. Yes. But yeah,
I wouldn't take mine to the fair either. It would not get a blue ribbon. I can assure you, if somebody with woodworking knowledge would see it and pick it apart, and it'd be ugly. But
what's the number like? Cornhole boxes? Is that what you're building for?
We did that a couple years ago.
Good
did
stuff.
A cornhole set. This year, my son wanted it because he wants it for his room. We're building a shelf. And then my daughter wants a wall hanger to put her purses and bags and stuff on. So, yeah.
It's like every woodworking project beyond that, you just start adding you just add new skills to it. Like, this is how we make a drawer. This is how we hinge things. And like the next thing you know, you're building furniture.
You're building
a curved nightstand. Yeah. Right? You just keep adding one step of not let's like that's how I started with building a bench. Melissa saw something. Think you could build that?
I don't know. Okay.
Probably. The next thing you know, like it was ugly, you know, but the next one's better. And then what about a desk?
Okay, sure. It's a bench with some drawers.
Yeah. And then it just you add one. Now I've done curved front. Like right now I've done curved plywood. Okay, now I can do the next thing. And that's
this year's change was we had been painting things in the past.
Oh god.
Now we introduced stain.
Oh, God, be with you.
Yeah, no, I know. And trying to... That's the thing with 4-H projects. Now you're not really supposed to do things for them.
Just do it. Just do it.
And you sit there, this is staying like...
Yes.
Stop.
Yes.
No.
Don't use the whole can, son. But yeah,
it's not paint. You don't have to dip the whole brush. No, that exact thing. Like, he was doing so well to start, and then...
Yeah, you run out of patience.
Reflex took over, and he just like, bloop. Yes. Oh.
Stand between coats.
Yes.
Yes. Yep. Little 300. Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah. No. Okay. That's enough woodworking. Okay, this enough is not woodworking. A woodworking
yes.
podcast.
Yes.
So I was enjoying let's talk it. About what we really came here to talk about, and that's Rush.
Rush. Yeah. You know, so is you what? So what's your question? What's your question for me in regards to Rush? What are you wondering?
So Rush is on tour again.
Yeah,
but
they
it's
are.
Not.
It's not
the
Rush.
OG Rush.
And I feel like I'm the only person on planet Earth who is not going and not thrilled and not happy about this. Everything I see on social media, everybody's going nuts. Like, this is great. I'm like, no.
Yeah, I'm shocked by this, Bill.
No. It's, I was so excited.
Me knowing you as a huge Rush fan.
Like, still
I
am.
I thought this would be like.
Grew up worshiping Neil Peart. Like, every 90s kid who played drums worshiped Neil Peart. So excited. He passed away in 2020, and now they have a new drummer, and I'm like, and I knew of her, and she's an amazing musician, and I saw one clip of them playing. They had one little minor gig. They played one song at some awards show, and I'm like, that's not how that song goes. So she's an amazing musician, stuff, you know, superhuman level, but she's not playing it the way it's supposed to be played, and that's why you go to a Rush concert. That's why you go. You hear these songs and you think, that guy's superhuman. How did he ever mechanically do that thing? And then you
get
to the
watch
concert
it.
And you get to, oh, that's what he's doing. Okay, all right, this really can be done. Okay. And so, yeah, like I started seeing the clips on YouTube. I'm like, that's not, you know, you don't go to see Beethoven's Fifth by, you know,
Kid Rock. By Bach.
Yeah, yeah, right. You want to hear it played. You don't want to hear the rap version of Beethoven's Fifth. You want to hear Beethoven's Fifth played the way it's supposed to be. And,
right.
And she's taking a lot of creative liberty, which is cool and whatever, but it's not. It's like.
Yeah, at that point, it's a, you know, there's many songs that have been re-recorded over the
more
years.
Power to you.
Like, great. Yeah, you want to do a tribute,
sure,
whatever you want to call
put
it.
Put your own spin on it, but don't.
But it's not, yeah.
It's not.
Don't slap the original product name on it and say this is
this. It's not. Yeah. And so
no, like, I get that.
I think I've yet to see anybody on social media be brave enough to stand up and be like, no, that's not how that's played. I go back to the whole, I was thinking about this on the way here. Like, yeah, if I go to see a Bach, and I've never would. Okay, I'm not that big of a dork, but like, you go there to hear that play the way it is, and that's there. She's taking her own creative liberty. I'm sure she could play it if she wanted to, but it's like, that's not, the drums don't sound like they don't sound like what the drums are supposed to sound like. She's not playing the parts the way they were composed. Like, this is a cover band.
Right. This is a really interesting cover band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Geddy Lee and Alex Lenson. With still the main singer, lead singer.
Maybe I'll break down and go someday, but I just can't bring myself, because I was like, the first thing I was doing, the first song I heard was, I was nitpicking, like, that's not right. Like, that's not all that, and not that I could play it, but I'm not saying I could ever play that stuff as well as it was composed, but sorry, man, I hate to be the downer on the Rush reunion. I was really excited to go see it, and I was going to get, you know.
I thought you were first in line for tickets.
I would have been.
You, yeah.
I would have been.
So you're more disappointed that it's not the pure Rush that you wanted, or the fact that there are still original members of Rush involved and they're not advocating for it to be played the way it should be?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the second thing. I'm really surprised that they're not like,
no, this is how you do it.
Yeah. They used to, I mean, Neil Peart would practice for 6 weeks before they went to practice with the band. Like, that was why I had such high, held him in such incredibly high regard. He was so disciplined. It's like, this is the way this song is played. He would practice before practice, right? He would practice his parts before he would then practice with the band, before they would then go on tour for 40 nights. And it was perfect, and it was crisp, and it was just meticulous, played note for note. I can't believe that Alex and Geddy aren't like, that's not how the song goes. I'm like, what? Anyhow. So I hate to be a downer, but I feel like I'm the lone voice in the crowd, because everybody else on social media is like, she's so great, she's so great. I'm like, well, she is. She's a great musician, but it's not Rush. Sorry. I'm sorry.
How many times have you seen Rush live?
Six.
Really?
Six times.
Six times.
Yeah.
Holy man. I knew it was more than one. I didn't realize. Six is a lot.
Yeah. It was.
Was it different experiences every time? I mean, they've got a lot of songs and a lot of very long songs.
I would say, you know, I saw my first one when I was a freshman in high school. I think I saw it, and then I saw my last one when I was, I mean, a dad. You know what I mean? Like, I was in, I think I saw in 08. I think 08. I saw the last one, like, that span. And so, yeah, it's a big, and I played music my whole life, so it's been a big part of my world. And if you go in my shop right now, I'm sure there's a Rush
8-track.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, but
record.
But yeah, it's record. It's very. It's very LP. Culty. It's very, like, you know, it's dorky. It's nerd rock. It is what it is.
But. Well, maybe that's well. So it's weird about it, as they're making their comeback. It's more mainstream now. They don't.
Yeah,
no
that
bands
is.
Like this any.
That's true.
It's easier to have one singer and let them. Have instead of paying a whole band, it just seems like we're getting more, you know, just the lead singer with a band, but not, you know, big bands. Like Rush was, and so
it is
yeah.
cool to see the mainstream attention. The fact that Todd Schomburg, like small town agronomist, knows that these guys are back out is pretty cool.
Right. I liked Rush back then, but I would have never. Yeah, they weren't. Yeah, I could see going to a concert then. It would have been a different feel and a really cool vibe with. With all other drummers, probably air drumming, everything.
Everybody's air drum. Like, yeah, you can look out and it would be cool. You'd see everybody's, not everybody, but like a quarter of the people's hands would be going to the music. Yeah. It would be just perfect. It was a neat thing. Yes. So to put it in perspective, the first I think 1990, they released a VHS tape that cost $20 of some of their tour stuff. And I didn't have $20. So my friend and I each gave 10.
Really?
We had to share it. Rush Chronicles on VHS.
Did you get it on weekends or during the week?
I don't remember how we did that, but I just remember watching that.
It was every other week.
Yeah. Did your buddy rewind or did you have to, were you pissed because you got it and rewind it every time?
I'm going to have to reach out and find out. I'd have to ask Bud where that ever ended up. But it was $20 at the mall in Sheboygan. And I remember like the day it came out, like we each had $10 and bought it. Like that's.
So, being that we've established they're more of a cover band, what do you think they should change their name to? Hurry Up?
How about Rash? Oh, there you go. That's Hurry Up. There you go. Yes.
Or to stick, since they're Canadian, French-Canadian, Plus Vite. Faster.
They probably would. Like, they are so self-deprecating. They're so non-rock star-esque that they would probably do something.
No matter how good the music is, I do appreciate the creativity of some cover bands in what they come up with their name.
Yes.
When they realize, you know, the comedy that can be there of like, oh yeah, we're a Beatles cover band, so we're the Scarabs, or, you know, something like that, where it may not be immediately obvious, but it's like, I see what you're doing there. Yeah.
Like Why Not is a Rush cover band. And if you don't,
right. Yes. If you don't know music, then you're
music,
not,
you know, like what, why would you? Yeah. That's, or the New World Men, or whatever. Yes, exactly. Yeah, yep. That's Ironically, that just to wrap that up with a bow, and like as I've lamented to Melissa many, many times, like go on YouTube. There's just Joe Dude in his basement playing those Neil Peart parts perfectly. Like if those guys, if just Joe Dude in suburbia can play Subdivisions perfectly by Rush, for God's sake. The drummer who's touring with them should be able to do it. Like, yeah, that's just all day long. I mean, that's what my social media feeds are like: woodworking and dudes playing Rush. Like, that's what it is. Right. It's just like,
so you've seen the there is
yes
people
over and over and over and over.
Well, for what I've heard, this lady she can do it, right?
I would think
they're
so.
Just kind of letting
amazing
her take
musician
her own liberties on it, and it'd be like you say, it'd be like, no, that's not.
It's probably the art versus the artist type of
there you go
argument
you
where go. They're good, you know, she feels she's the way she does it is her art,
her reflection,
as opposed to Neil's art was how he did it, and we can argue it as we have been, but from her
you're
perspective,
gonna play Subdivisions. You're going to play Subdivisions. You play it, whatever. Those iconic parts. You play it like that.
Well,
Joe Satriani is touring with, is it Joe Satriani? Is touring with, or Steve Vai. One of those guys is touring with Sammy Hagar.
Okay.
And they're doing some of the old Van Halen stuff. And like, I think it's Satriani. Like, I've seen some of those clips and like, it sounds like Eddie Van Halen. It sounds the guitar sound, but the sound of the guitar is the same, and the mechanics. He's playing Summer Nights, and it's like incredible. It sounds like Eddie Van Halen, and that's what I was expect. That's what I was hoping and expecting yep. for with this.
Well, and we talked about Journey before recording. Yeah, that they did the same thing with
guy.
Yeah, with the lead singer they had to replace, and they found somebody who
sounds like him.
Like him. Yeah. So it was a, you know, for people who were fans who, you know, enjoyed that music, they made it so that they were playing for those people.
Yeah.
So, which isn't always the case. But
okay, all right. This is an agronomy podcast.
What?
Yes.
This isn't 80s classic Canadian rock. Bands?
Yes.
Okay. So we're not going to talk about...
The Triumph return. Triumph is touring again.
So we're not going to talk about just Canadian bands in general? Or Bare Naked Ladies is not our next topic? Okay.
No Gordon Lightfoot. Yes.
Ooh. Really? You hate the Edmund Fitzgerald that much?
Yeah. That's what... Love that song.
Remind me to show you a bumper sticker. I enjoy.
Duly anyway, noted.
You're right. We should probably actually talk about agronomy type things. Yes. So today we are going to talk about poop because you were the poop czar, right?
I was the poop czar back in the day.
The poop czar.
And it's ironic. This is the first time I've called you guys up and been like, you know, I keep getting the same topic of conversation over and over. What if we did a podcast about this? So usually it's the opposite, but this is something like, yeah, I keep running into this on conversations on dairies all the time.
But Bill, once you told me that you ran into it, I ran into it then multiple times.
Gotcha.
Oh, yes, we need...
Nobody likes running into poop.
No, I've run into poop a lot. But yes, this we need to find a way to cultivate these relationships between...
One does not simply walk into poop.
Yes. No. Yeah.
They run into
poop. How do we kind of bridge the gap? But as our dairies are getting bigger, land is getting tighter and harder to come by. We are seeing more and more and more cooperating agreements between cash grain guys and dairies as far as growing crops and buying manure back. And yeah, it seems, and the irony is that if you go to Kansas, if you go to the Dakotas or whatnot, it's the norm. That's just what you have your 1,000-cow dairy that sits on 400 acres, and then you buy all your crops and sell all your manure. It's just a normal. It's as normal as selling your crop to the elevator in town.
Right. That's a good point, Bill. Is the way that industry came about, the grain farmers were already there.
Yep.
Yeah. And then the livestock or whatever the manure farmers will call them came in, and so that agreement kind of started that way in Wisconsin, I'm guessing in parts of New York, Pennsylvania, where it was the dairy farmer first in a way. I mean, there was always grain farmers around, but it was, you know, you guys did dairy and you cropped and we do crop. Yeah. And now that relationship can take place more and
absolutely.
They can work together.
The guy milks 1,000 cows, he wants to go to 2,000, but the land just... is so expensive, as well as he wants to specialize in, he wants to manage his dairy and doesn't want to buy another $3 million worth of machinery to double his land base, and he's got a crop grower next door. So yeah, it's time to put this together.
In the other coin, we've seen crop growers that want to specialize, and they just want to grow crops. They don't want to...
Right, they don't want to deal with cattle.
They don't want to milk cows.
Yeah. And the custom industry, as far as manure hauling and custom chopping, I would say, has gone that way too. Those guys, typically, some of them farm, you know, or most of them do farm as well, but not always. Some of them are just...
And look how much better they are.
Right.
Look how good our custom guys are now. Not to throw water on what some of the pioneers did in that industry 20 years ago with custom work, but man, I mean, you look at the technology and the professionalism of our custom operators now. It's mind-blowing. Yeah. They've developed, they like to use your phrase, they've really specialized. They've gotten really serious about it. And
yeah, they know what they're doing. They can come in, get it in, get it done, and get out the door.
Yep. Yeah.
What I find interesting, too, about this concept is, like you said, Todd, we had the dairy first, and actually a lot of these grain guys, somewhere in their past, probably had a dairy farm involved.
Yeah,
very much or so. Had cattle, and they're separated, sometimes by one generation, sometimes by multiple, from that dairy aspect, so it's not... Not necessarily that they're not familiar with it or that there's no history of it. It's just that they're not sure how to use it. In some cases, they want it because they know the value of it. Other cases, they're like, well, I hated dealing with that stuff, or now I have to do X, Y, Z, because if I get this, then I, you know, it's just easier to call the co-op and bring fertilizer out, but fertilizer gets expensive too. And so these conversations are good to have and good to establish that relationship, because in the end, they might have misconceptions because they didn't milk the cows. They didn't have to haul the manure because of that separation. So,
yeah, absolutely. They're still, as well as, so how do I say this? Manure is good, but you know, now I'm doing all this precision ag and I can't, how do I do precision ag with, and I'm still envisioning hauling with my tandem box spreader in 1981.
You're just going to come out here and throw MedPak randomly across the
field. And you're going to get stuck and it's going to be a mess and blah, blah, blah. So how do we bridge that, or how do we,
It's mindsets. And
so, what it reminds me of, or how do I say this? Like, what I often tell dairy farmers is like, welcome to my world. Now you get to be a salesman. Now you're a salesperson. You literally have to, you know, get in your truck and you go knock on the door of your customer, the grain farmer. And
It went from a fertilizer source, a waste product, finger quotes, to a product. Now
you have to go sell it.
Yep.
Now you have to go and you have to get in your truck and you go talk to that grain farmer and you have to develop the relationship. You have to have in the back of your mind, you have to know that he might object to the cost, the compaction, the neighbor relations, the regulations, there doesn't have any nitrogen in it. That all goes away. So in your back of your mind, you have to know going in that these are some of the objections your cash crop customer might have, whether that's I want to buy his silage or whether I want to do manure. So the main one, one of the main ones that I always hear crop guys object to is that, well, that stuff's mostly water. It's just liquid. It's mostly water. And the answer is correct. Correct. It is mostly water.
It is liquid dairy manure.
It is anywhere from 90 to 95% water. That's just what it is. And we account for that when we count the nutrients. We're not selling the water portion of it. We're sending this to a lab and saying there's X amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash, and sulfur, and all the micronutrients. It has if you went to the co-op to replace it, it would cost this. Therefore, I'm selling it to you highly discounted at this. So it's all taken into consideration. In the same way that you know how many units of fertilizer you're getting coming out of the back of the buggy that you're getting from the co-op, we know the same coming out of the hose or the truck that's delivering manure to your farm. So, yeah, a lot of that is water. That's just the reality of it, which is really nice when you're putting that on an alfalfa crop in summer, quite frankly. But, yeah, that's all taken into consideration. Same with the whole idea that the other objection you often hear, and you and I have battled this back in the day, you guys and I have battled this, is all that nitrogen is volatilizes. It just goes away. It just goes away. There is no nitrogen in that manure. And the answer to that is you're two-thirds right. You're two-thirds right in that when we send a manure sample to a lab, and I'm looking at a manure sample right here, and the total nitrogen in that manure is 10 units per thousand. The total nitrogen, that is how much nitrogen is in 1,000 gallons of manure, is 10. And the column right next to it says, first year of application, you count 3. So we are conceding the point that a lot of the nitrogen volatilizes. We lose a lot. Yes.
Well, let me caveat there is that some of that's converted into organic matter into it. We know by the research that 30% surface applied, 40% incorporated, and 50% of it when you inject will be available the first year. Some, as your sheet shows, will be available the second year. Yep. Some will be available the third year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when somebody objects and says so much of that nitrogen volatilizes, your answer back should be yes, correct. We're agreeing with that, and it's all accounted for when you get your bill. When you get your report as far as how much nitrogen we're delivering, that's if the fertilizer buggy comes from the co-op and they spill half of it on the way, they're only going to bill you for half the fertilizer. That's probably a really bad analogy to use.
But analogy to fertilizer bee is, yes, they might apply 100 pounds of urea, which would be 46 units. But if it
could volatilize.
It could volatilize as well. Like, not all of that as well is perfectly into the system. You know, it's so.
There you go.
As we sit here today, a good example of that, I think, would be, look how much rain we've gotten in the last 2 weeks. If I applied my nitrogen right before the rain started, sometimes that's a good thing. We want it to wash in because the surface applied nitrogen is going to volatilize. That's not just me saying it. That's a fact of life when it comes to untreated urea. If it's treated, it'll last a little bit longer. You know, there's different ways to manage that, especially if it's surface applied. Same with manure. We surface apply manure. We actually probably lose more nitrogen to volatilization than we would if we inject it or incorporate it.
For sure. Yep. And it's all accounted. Like, keep going. I'm sorry.
Sorry. And it's all accounted for. But if we keep getting rain, and some areas have gotten 2, 3, 4, 5 inches, we went from washing it in, getting it to where the roots need it, to nitrogen's a mobile thing. Your fertilizer could be just pushed right through profile and be gone. Whereas manure, as Todd was pointing out, yes, there is some volatilization. There's only so much available the first year. As an organic product, the organic matter in that is going to slowly break down. It's not as available and not as prone to the volatilization as a commercial product.
Boom.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like where you're going with that, Bill, because I think you're right in that they're used to buying commercial fertilizer. That grain farmer is comfortable with that scenario. In the same way, you know, say to a lawn or something like that, you call up a place, they come and put it on. Okay, it worked. I call up co-op, they come and apply it. It's done. This is so new to them, and like I think you guys alluded to, most of the guys we work with that are grain farmers have dairy history, but there's so many generations removed that it's re-talking that through of, we're talking units of fertilizer, of, you know, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, here's what you're getting, and this is the product. And
yeah,
I think the product, I always thought manure would sell itself. I really did. It's such a perfect blend of everything. I mean, you're getting micronutrients, you're getting like, all of that, but it's also a blend that you maybe get a little too much of something that you don't need all the time.
Sure.
And not, you know, whereas at the co-op, they can literally dial that in now for them. So it does take a little bit of sell. Like you say, I think as a dairyman, they maybe thought, well, this would be easy to, you know, sure, why wouldn't he want it? Why right? Wouldn't they want it?
It's like Chris Hansen inoculant. Why wouldn't you want this?
Don't you?
Why do I have to actually get in my truck and tell you about it? You should just use this stuff. Yeah, duh. But yeah, that's good. It's the way you say that. Like, yeah, dairymen are oftentimes that isn't like, this is the best stuff ever. Why would I need to sell this to you? Like,
yes.
It's manure. It's gold. Like, yeah, we all know that because we're in the dairy business. But Joe, grain farmer, is doing precision ag in meticulously placing his micronutrients X amount of inches from the row. Like, yeah, no, like, yeah, that's a good. Yeah.
Well, and as you were talking with the manure sample, it's important to have that as an example. Absolutely. To show that.
Yes.
But also, you can't just hand it to them as a pamphlet, like, oh, see what you're going to get.
Yeah.
Because they're not used to reading it. They're not going to look at it like, oh, okay, yeah. No, this totally makes sense. Like, well, why is there four different numbers of nitrogen here? What is that supposed to mean?
I remember saying this to a lot of guys when they were hesitant to try this, is that, like, the worst thing that could happen to me as a dairy manager is for me to tell you you're getting 120 units of N. You then write your prescription was that the right way to put that?
Yeah.
And I only gave you 60, and now you're 60 units short of N. Your corn looks like hell. That is the worst thing that can happen to me, the dairyman, as I'm trying to grow my relationships in the neighborhood and sell my product. Trust me, if I tell you you're getting 120, I'm going to make damn sure you're getting 120.
The sample shows
the worst thing that could happen is for Mr. Kick-Ass, meticulous dairy crop farmer to have a poor crop that everybody in the neighborhood, oh, yeah, boy, did you see his crop over there? It looks, oh, that's because he had that dairy manure on there. That's why that looks so bad. Like, that's like the worst case scenario. Like, no one's going to, as well as the opposite is true. If that guy grows an awesome crop of corn, which I want him to do, all the neighbors are going to drive by and be like, yeah, I saw he's working with that dairy over there, that crop, the corn, look at the corn crop. That, I mean, it's like any other product you're selling. Like, the work, like, I have a vested, the last thing I'm going to do is short you, is to sort of like scam you into making a few extra bucks per acre by scamming you thinking there's more nitrogen here. It nothing could be worse for me than doing that and you growing half a crop of corn and the whole world seeing it. Like, I have a vested interest in making sure if I tell you you got 100 units, man, you got at least 100 in there.
Well, and that gets back to something you mentioned before about the concept of, you know, the box spreader or the, you know, oh, yeah, you're just going to come out and dump it on the ground is the technology for manure application has changed quite a bit in the last how many years as well. You know, you can get a more, you know, if you're custom operator or hauler is doing flow meters and all this stuff, you can get an as applied map. You can know, all right, here's where it was spread. If for some reason they would run out, you know, they can tell you where they stopped and show you things that before, you know, the concept of manure was just watching a guy plod through the field, looking for, oh, I think it was about here I stopped last Tuesday when I had to haul out the calf barn. Now I'm going to start here again. And
I'm going to put the same amount of calf manure on as I am dairy manure, which is not the same as, you know,
right.
Exactly.
It's not the same product.
It's not the same products.
And then, you know, I can't haul it today, so Bob over there is going to haul it, and he drives a little bit faster or a little bit slower. And
yeah, that is not how we do things anymore, especially with the hose rigs. They've got auto steer on them. They've got the in-field mapping and whatnot. Yeah, this is a whole new world.
Yeah, and even just the hose rig itself and the ability of moving hose and getting that application, because one of the arguments I think we've all probably heard about manure is, well, I don't want semis driving through my field.
Yep.
All that compaction, all that, you know, it's going to mess up my field. The technology's gotten around that. We can do it other ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess that, which then of course leads to the next question of what does it cost? How much is it worth? And the answer, in my humble opinion, is whatever somebody will pay for it. So thank you. It's been fun, guys. I'm done. It's been an interesting one to watch from my vantage point now being out in industry. It's interesting in the sense of there's like a corn basis, there's like a manure basis, just like there is your proximity to the ethanol plant dictates your corn price. Yeah. Your proximity to dairies dictates your manure price.
Yep.
So my colleague, we were doing some math, we were doing some counting the other day. My colleague has a small grain farm. He's near Valders, Wisconsin. And if you've ever been to Valders, you know that there'd be a whole lot of cows and a whole lot of farms around Valders. So we counted up. We think there's somewhere between 15 and 20 farms with manure lagoons close enough that could bring him manure. 15 to 20. Land prices are crazy high there. And so needless to say, on his grain farm, his manure cost is a lot lower. We'll just say that. We'll just say his manure cost is that a lot substantially lower than if you went to grain country where you had one dairy surrounded by grain guys. If you went to Ripon or Waupun or something like that. And again, I realize this isn't just a local podcast we're doing here, but that's an area that has better land, quite frankly, more grain, more canning crops, more specialty stuff with a couple of dairies. So obviously the value of the manure is different in those two areas. It just is. Like, you can be Grandpa Simpson and shout at the clouds all you want, but that's the reality.
Yeah, it's like driving, you need to get gas, and you come to an intersection, and there's four gas stations, one in each corner. Whatever one's cheapest or better quality is probably the one you're going to pick because there's competition, versus you're out in Montana driving to the middle of nowhere. The last gas sign was 30 miles ago. Here comes a gas station. Well,
we're going to stop.
This is where we're stopping. This is what we got.
Yeah. If he charges you $3 for his Diet Mountain Dew or whatever, or $4, whatever.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're going to pay what
it is.
It's what it is.
So yeah, there's so much. There's a lot of that. Your as well as simply your the situation the dairy has. Is it a dairy that just has a bunch of its own land, but has some grain guys close by that just want it? Or is this a dairy that needs, that, you know, doesn't have any of its own land and needs to work with those groups? All those things can really impact that price of that manure. But the one thing, the one thing that I hear from dairymen is that my grain farming neighbor said he'll pay me the equivalent of a half a cent a gallon, and it cost me 2.5 to get it there. Doesn't he understand that I'm losing money here? And I'm like, yes, but that's not how he's looking at that.
He doesn't care.
He's
looking at the like you just said, the manure sample value plus the, I like your manure basis term, so maybe minus the manure basis.
And yeah,
that's the price. Like you said, that's the price he's willing.
That's the price he is willing to pay.
Pay,
and yeah. He's saying I'm willing to pay you 75% of what it would cost me to go to the co-op. That's what I'm basing my when I go to sell somebody silage inoculant. It's based on the value of the product I'm selling. It has nothing that he's not looking at my freight cost or anything like that. He's simply saying, this is the value. I think it's better than your competitors, and I think it's better than this cheap brand over here. I'm willing to pay you X for the value of this product. And that's what a grain farmer is doing. He doesn't care. Now, I mean, you can lean on him and say, no, I got to have more. Like, you're further away. I got to have more. I got to have 0.75 cents because you're 11 miles away. And that's the game. Then now it becomes a negotiation. Now it becomes...
Yeah. Which grain farmers are used to, because that's when they market their grain, what they have to deal with too.
Yeah.
Your co-op down the road might be paying one price, but I can truck it 30 miles further and get a better price for it. And so I might do that.
Absolutely.
Or so, I might leave it in the bin.
Or it might leave it, right. And that grain guy would say, nope, I'm not willing to do that. How about 6 cents? You know, that's just business. That's just business negotiations at that point. But you have to put your salesman hat on. You have to look at it through the eyes of your customer. You have to know what his objections might be. And again, you have to sell the value of it. Sell me this pen, right? Like it's when you say sell me the pen or sell me the pencil, nobody cares what quality graphite it's made out of. They only care what it can do.
Right. Does it work?
Does it work? Right. And so that's,
I think how do you, farmers look at the manure is very freight cost related. The 100% of the cost is freight.
Yeah.
It's in transporting the manure.
Yep.
And so fertilizer, there's also a large freight cost that that's mined out of Canada somewhere, and has a large part of that is the freight to get it there and then the distribution cost. But the co-op isn't saying, well, the diesel price is a little higher right now, so it's automatically we're going to charge a whole bunch of surcharges on to get it to your farm. Or if the co-op is in Pickett, Wisconsin, and you're 30 miles away, they don't charge that guy any more than they do the guy a mile away. So where I'm going with my question, Bill, would be, do you think that grain farmers, they wouldn't have any, they don't care how far they are from your farm necessarily. I mean, that's part of the negotiation, because they're used to buying a product currently that there's a co-op around in general that's close enough to get it, and that's not part of the negotiation with the co-op, isn't
it? Is,
well,
not.
You're this far away.
So the better you can do of marketing it, and it sounds almost silly, right? We're talking about marketing shit, right?
right.
Like, it sounds almost goofy, but the reality is the better job that you can do marketing it, managing it, selling it, the more demand you can then create. So the higher so then you can lean on those further. So in other words, if you're charging a half a cent to somebody that's 15 miles away, and he's growing awesome crops, and all of a sudden you're close guys, now this guy that was really dragging his feet, who's next door, he sees that crop and he sees how well it's going and how well it's managed. He's like, you know what? I see what you're doing over 11 miles away. I'm next door. Can I get some too? And you're like, hells yes, you can. Now you have the leverage to go to the guy who's 11 miles away and say, you know what? All right, I'm going to have to raise my price, fuel prices, whatever. That's just the reality. And it just becomes, then it becomes the game. It yep. becomes the Donald Trump sort of art of the deal kind of thing. That's what it ends up being. And so, but again, if you do a crappy job, if you do a poor job of managing it, if you do your neighbor relations suck, if you're a jerk to deal with, if you wreck his fields, well, then nobody's going to want it, and you're not going to be able to.
There's no value there.
There's no value in there, and you're not going to demand any price. You're not going to be able to get any value out of it. So that's, yeah, it's you got to put your salesman's hat on in dealing with this, and yeah, show what your product can do. And the more you can do that, the higher price you can then demand from it.
Yeah. So, Bill, in your time in dealing with manure, you dealt with a lot of those issues that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. Now we have more of a, I don't want to call it a kick, or maybe it's a fad, maybe it's not, but the idea of soil health.
Yeah.
And biologicals.
Oh, absolutely.
And all those types of products. Manure fits that category too. And so how do you think that changes the game a little bit? Do you think it's there yet, or do you think that's just another tool in the toolbox to say, hey, not only that, do you get the nutrients, but...
That.
Yeah.
That. I think that goes back to the put your salesman's hat on and know your customer, and know that if that's a dude that's trying every new biological on the market, and you know, as you develop those relationships and you see Joe at the coffee shop, you see him at the dealership and whatever, and you start building that relationship, and he's one of these soil nerds that's all about the biology. Oh yeah, you definitely play that hand. Again, it's just like selling cars. It's listening to what your customers' needs are. It's like selling the pencil, whatever.
Yep.
And then you direct. So the guy that doesn't, the guy that's just, I don't care. Like, I use fertilizer and I grow some corn and I work my ass off. Like, okay, he probably, if you start talking about biologics, he might totally turn the guy off. Oh, that's just a bunch of hooey. Right. But like, right. That guy's just, I want some cheap fertilizer. Okay. Well, that's the sales pitch that we're going to use. So yeah, it's a good point. Like, yeah, know your customer. And, you know, so it's the same with, when we had talked about this before, I said, like, make sure you have the doomsday conversation with your customer, with your grower. And, here's the doomsday, like, imagine that you're selling manure to Joe, the no-till guy, right? You finally got him convinced that this is a good thing. We're going to dribble bar, fill in the blank. We're going to dribble bar some manure on your cover crop after wheat. And okay, all right. And this guy's Mr. No-till, RTK, you know, a million soil samples a year, just meticulously managing every acre he's got. He's got his prescriptions to the nth degree. And then it starts raining in July, and you're like, oh, he's next on the list for manure. And you take your articulate 9R John Deere at an angle with a dribble bar, and you rut the whole thing crossways because you were out there when it was wet and you wrecked his field. That's probably the last time that dude's ever going to work with you ever again.
Yes, right, for sure.
So when I say talk about the doomsday scenario, I think back to 2019 and 2020, and I think of what we had to do to get our lagoons empty. Let's just put the cards on the table. That was a scary deal. In 2019 and 2020, we had late planting in spring. Yep. And it never stopped raining in fall. And if we hadn't had the December that we did, I don't want to think about what would have happened.
Right.
We emptied a lot of lagoons in December. You need to have the conversation with your grower to say, what are we going to do if we get into this situation? Like, we need to have, like, same with buying silage, right? You're the last guy, your silage is planted a little later, so you're the last guy that we're going to chop, and then all of a sudden it starts raining, but we got to go get the silage, and we're dragging dump carts on the frame through your meticulously managed. Like, that's a scenario that might happen. Same with the manure. Like, we got to get this lagoon empty. I'm counting on your acres, and it's not ideal. And I'm not telling you to not haul manure. I'm not telling you you should haul manure. I'm saying you guys need to be on the same page to know that 1 year out of 15, stuff like that happens. And we need to have this conversation now. Like, I need to know that those acres are there for silage or manure. I can't, if you're half my land that I'm counting on, I can't, that's the reality. Okay. And so I would rather have that conversation up front and that guy be like, no way in hell are we doing this. If that's going to happen in 1 in 15 years, no way are we
I'm
doing
out.
This.
Right.
I'm out.
I like
okay,
that.
Good.
Yeah.
Then let's be out right now.
Right.
Let's maybe right. We'll do some side deals here and there, but you can't be my number one go-to guy. Right. Like, yeah. Let's have this conversation in 2026 when it's beautiful and the lagoons are empty and corn looks great. Let's have this scenario now, not in 2019 when it doesn't stop raining and I'm in.
Right, and you got to get a corn silage crop off quickly.
There's a fleet of dump carts getting to be pulled by log skidders, right? Like, that's what we're going to chop, and we're pulling choppers out backwards with wreckers. Like, that's going to happen sometime in everybody's lifetime to have a spring like that. So, go ahead.
I think along that line, too, part of the, I don't know if risk is the right word, but the thought process on the dairy side is not only you wanting to make sure the customer is happy, but unfortunately in the world we live in, there's also the side of like, okay, but it's got to be this, like, if I'm going to give you this manure and we're going to give you 120 units, it better be corn. If you switch it to snap beans or you switch it to wheat or whatever, like, there's that side of the conversation too, is there has to be a good relationship, because sometimes there's those needs of like, if you do this, I get in trouble. Like, yeah. I want to work with you. I want us both to be happy, but the crop's got to be the crop. Like, we're fertilizing
That's a really good point going along with that. Like, let's not, you know, the temptation to get the quick sale. Don't. Yeah. Yeah. Make sure that we're all on the same page. In other words, if I'm selling inoculant to a farm and I'm like, and I see that things are not, equipment is not meant well maintained on that farm. And I'm like, if you don't maintain this applicator, if you do not clean it, it will plug and you will have issues and you will hate me and I will be angry and whatnot. So we need to say this right now. Like, there's a rinse tank on that applicator for a reason. Like, you need to clean your stuff. This is a live bacteria you're putting. I would rather have that kind of awkward conversation again now when the sun is shining rather than in the middle of silage when he's got a disaster on his hands.
And a lot of times then that conversation, what I've seen, doesn't even happen, is the, say in this case with silage, the dairy farmer's like, well, we don't have a choice, and they just kind of do it, and then the grain farmer's ups, because A, even if they did have the conversation in the heat of the battle, it's not going to go well, and there's no other outcomes besides that. And I would agree with you, Bill, if it's probably a 1 out of 15 year,
But that day's coming.
Right. And as long as that conversation's had, it's like, hey, we've had a really good relationship, and there's going to be this time where you're not going to be happy, and you're going to have to look the other, you know, we're going to have to get a deep ripper out and fix some things, but that's got to
happen. Just know that there's a real possibility if we work together long enough.
Right.
Someday that scenario is going to happen. Right. And again, that's, and if a guy's like, nope, we're not doing that. Okay, no problem. I might get you 100 acres of manure sometimes here or there. I might buy some spot silage here from you year in, year out if I'm short. Okay, but I can't.
Right.
I can't make you my go-to grower next door. So the other part of that is like, man, when you do get those growers, you get those growers that like, yeah, I get it. We got to chop the corn. Get the wrecker and the snowplow to get the mud off the road and whatever. Go do it. I get it. Like, those are your new friends, man. Like, that needs to be the first guy that you call when you need some custom work done, or that needs to be the first guy you work on a land swap, or like, whatever, here, borrow my bush hog or whatever it is. Like, you cannot put too high a value on the relationships with the growers who get it.
Yep.
So I was really fortunate when I was in the trenches doing this that I was competing with canning factories. Like, the canning factories, we were competing for acres.
Yep.
And that's the ultimate of like, oh.
They just go.
Like, it's monsoon raining, but the peas are ready. Okay.
Yep.
We're going.
And that's part of the, somewhat part of the known contract going in of like, they pay you pretty well.
Yep.
Not great necessarily, but pretty well. And
we might leave 4-foot ruts in your field. You might be able to bury a small child in the ruts left by the pea combine. Yeah. Like, that's okay. So I had that was a big advantage to that they were used to that. The people that I was wanting to work with had that in the back of their mind. But, you know, I also had people that were, oh, no, you're not, like, I no-till everything. Okay, cool, man, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I strip-till everything, and, boy, you can't wreck my, okay, that's cool. Like, I'm glad we're having this conversation now.
Right.
Before I'm, you know, Joe, the dump cart guy, is going diagonally across your field, leaving 2-foot ruts, right? Like, I'm glad we're having this conversation now. But yeah, you can't overemphasize the value of the relationships with those growers. Like, yeah, like, you just can't.
I like that what you're saying in the sales pitch really is talking about the positives, but also talking about what you started with earlier was the neighbors, how did that relationship, the compaction and the value there. Like, it's talking about it. When we sell things, we always want to think we're going to talk about all the positives, but you're saying make sure you have the conversations of the negatives up front too, yeah, so that you can, everybody's on the same page.
We're all on the same page. Yeah. And we can air those objections now. It's a lot easier to air those objections in June when the sun is shining and everything's peachy and hash it out than it is on the 1st of October, again, when you got the snowplow plowing the mud off the road. And yeah,
some of that might come out of, well, the grain farmer has a certain landlord.
Oh, that, yeah.
Oh, no, if we got to do that in, you know,
yep,
Bill's field, I'd be fine with it, but he's not, yeah, you know, and then you, okay, so.
So, yeah, well, very good point.
It pulls out then, or like in this case, it may not even be the grain farmer himself, probably isn't, it's the landlord or the grain farmer's dad comes out and says, you know,
yeah,
choose so that guy, new those, one, right, because you can have all that ahead of time, and then.
So in other words, is what you're saying is like the other reason to have those conversations is to make sure, like, it might, those objections might not end the relationship going forward, but maybe that guy never thought of the fact that renter Bob,
right,
would have an absolute brain hemorrhage meltdown if he saw the dump cart again,
right,
going crossways across his conservation strips or whatever, right, fill the blank.
Right.
Like, or,
so he can then have the conversation with those people, or say
we're not doing those acres. Yeah,
those acres.
I never thought of that.
Like, those acres are, because a lot of times what I do see with the grain, it's not actually the grain farmer that's all that upset. It's the trickle down to who he works.
The landlord. Yep. It's the town official.
Right. Yeah. That now he has to do some fixing. Where if he knows ahead of time, like, okay, this might happen, I've had those conversations with the right people as well.
So good.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say. Back to the question of what is manure worth? Would you guys say that maybe a place to start is half its value, half its commercial value? Is that where a lot of those conversations maybe start?
That's the starting point. I would agree. What I can,
I think this gets
into the part of, like, that's why some of these don't happen, is neither party knows where to start. There's not an open market. There's not a.
Oh yeah, there's not a Chicago Board of Trade.
Correct. There's no market.
Yeah.
To this at all.
Right.
So then it starts to, where do we start? And at times it was hauling cost. That seems to be one that, like we just said, the guy buying it doesn't care about what percentage of your hauling costs. He doesn't care. He cares about the value in the fertilizer he's getting. And as fertilizer too has gone up, and they can say, okay, fertilizer is this high, but I can pay, still get that same amount of fertilizer, but pay, in this case, half the price.
Yep,
that's a good
and maybe that's a good deal. Again, for the start where you say, I've got a dairy and I've got all. I don't really need anybody right now. I don't need other growers, but I got a cash grain guy who's just begging for it.
Right.
So maybe it's more than half a cent a gallon.
Correct.
And then the opposite is true of I really, like, I'm next door to you and you have whatever you need, you're looking for places to go with it, and I'm next door. Well, maybe it's not worth a half. Maybe it's worth 25%, whatever. But it's a starting point.
And that's where I was going to go with it. Is we've talked a lot about trying to get someone to take manure, but when you have the opposite issue of, like, they will take all they can get and more.
Yes,
is that can complicate things too. Like, well, I want you to put like 30,000 gallons in the field. Okay, like I appreciate your enthusiasm, but. You know, I have growers that have dealt with that, where it's like,
well, put as much on as he can.
Yep, I want you to put at least, and Todd, you've had growers the opposite, like, nope, you're only going to put this much.
Yeah, that it's very, like, too low, and then you got to talk to the hauler, what's the lowest you can go, and how do we...
I bet they love that.
Yes, you can imagine that they do not.
Yeah.
And so that conversation is part of it, you're right, of how do we do that.
Yeah, it's not all, you know, please take my manure. Sometimes it's like, okay, look,
yeah.
I appreciate the enthusiasm, but I only produce X number of gallons a year.
Yep,
and absolutely. I can only give you this much.
Yeah, if you, again, not to name drop or whatnot, but in the world that I had come from, yeah, by the time wheat comes off, well, that's the same time peas come off and sweet corn would come off. Fields are dry as a bone. Phone rings off the hook for manure.
Right.
I mean, you got to try to figure out who you're going to make, you're going to disappoint. But then when spring rolls around, well, that's a different, there's less demand. So, yeah, it's the game. You're right. You can be on both sides of that coin in 6 months' time.
I like your starting point, Bill. I appreciate you bringing that up because I do think as agronomists, when people ask you what the value is, we're nerdy and you're going, it says right on the manure thing and the fertilizer, you know, it should be $120 a load, you know, whatever it is. And that's not, this is, like you said, this is a negotiation.
Yeah.
In the same way when you're buying fertilizer, there's some negotiation depending on if those guys are buying 20 ton, that might be a different story than a guy buying 150 ton.
For sure.
Is a different story. So I like what you said. I never thought of part of the problem is we don't have a good starting point for both of these. And I to kind of circle back, I do agree with your, the more I think about it, you're kind of the half of the nutrient value is a good
starting point. So the same goes for when you talk silage contracts, kind of get the same. And I think one of the big misnomers or things that I think we've done wrong is, so let's say you have an 8 multiplier.
Okay. I follow where you're going. So this would be the multiplier. So you basically take the tons of silage to get to the amount of grain.
Right. No. This is my pet peeve.
Right.
This is my pet peeve. The misnomer is that your multiplier, your 7, your 8, your 9 is some sort of mathematical equation that changes tons of silage to bushels of corn.
Correct.
I totally disagree with that. Completely disagree with that. It's not like that. My opinion is the 7, the 8, the 9, whatever that number is, that is simply the multiplier. It is simply the market. It's the basis. It's what your neighborhood will allow you to buy silage for. That's all it is. I don't think it's – did it start that way back in the day at like 7? Oh, if you have 150 bushel corn, or if you have 20-ton silage, that's 140 bushel corn. Like, no, that doesn't – regardless.
Well, maybe a good way to say it, if you look at the data, it's a huge range of 6 to 11. Yeah. Yes,
it is.
It lands around 7 to 10.
Yeah, but it's a big range.
We're trying to take tons of a whole plant and convert it to what would be on the cob.
We're simply saying this is the market value that I am willing to pay for silage.
For silage, right?
You, Mr. Grain Farmer, you take that, you put it in your spreadsheet, and you tell me if my price is sufficient for you to bring me a product. That's what 7, 8, 9, 10 is.
Where the debate comes to, well, I think it should be 7.8, and you think it should be,
And there is that debate.
But the debate hinges on, they think that's how much grain is in there.
And that's not.
And you're saying,
no, disconnect throw that out there.
Because it can vary, and you're never going to agree. And both sides probably, there's times where the grain farmer's right, and there's times where the
absolutely
the farmer, farmers. The buyer's absolutely. Right.
It comes down to me saying, I think I'm going to have 20 ton. You're going to have an 8 multiplier at, say, the price of corn is $4 a bushel. It's about me doing the math and saying, this is what I'm going to gross. This is what it's going to cost. These are the pros of doing silage. These are the cons of doing silage. Yes, I'm going to sell you my product. No, I'm not. That's what the 7, 8, 9 multiplier is. Throw that. We need as an industry, forget this whole bushel equivalency. It's not a thing. It's simply.
It is a thing, but that's not the debate. Yeah.
Right. The debate. It's the basis. It's a silage basis is what I think it is.
A good way maybe to caveat that is BMR corn.
Oh gosh.
That's going away, so we shouldn't even have this conversation. Maybe where I'm going
only,
with it.
Only because of the conversation of forage pricing, not because it's a bad food, but
most dairymen are going to pay towards the higher end of that, towards 10. on that multiplier because they're getting a higher quality product.
Yes.
So what I'm saying in general is if you're providing a higher quality product to the dairyman, he's probably going to pay on the higher end of that if you're providing
it. You have more leverage to negotiate a higher price if you're providing a higher product, a higher quality product.
Right. Yes. So again, I like your disconnect from this is the amount of bushels. It's just that's the multiplier you used. You put it into your formulas. Does the end number
work? Does the end number make you say, Mr. Businessman, yes, I will sell you my product, or no, I won't? That's what, yeah.
And then where...
Go ahead.
Where do you go with moisture then?
These are all negotiated things that you need to put in the spreadsheet to say, yes, I'll do this. In other words, we need to understand that if we correct the dry matter to 33, 34, 35, that changes it. Do we base the per bushel price on Chicago? Do we base it on a local place? Do we base it on a local minus a basis, Chicago basis? These are all things we need to put this all into the giant spreadsheet and then negotiate from there. And I go to central Wisconsin where you wait in line for 3 hours with your corn semi and then have a pretty crappy basis. And then I work with farms that are next door to the ethanol plant in Oshkosh where you just pull in and whatever, like you wait for 15 minutes and you dump your truck and you're back out the field. Like, and they have a fantastic basis to get you to bring, like, it's the same with silage. Like if you're in a neighborhood with a whole bunch of other dairies, you have more of a negotiating position than you do in a place where it doesn't. And then you can negotiate those basis and those, how you price your corrections. Remember, the lower the dry matter corrected, the higher the multiplier. I got that right? In other words, like a 7.5 with a 33% dry matter correction is about the same as an 8 or whatever. You got to do the math in there, but the higher the dry matter correction, the lower the pay price.
What do you think the normal for those two are? What's the average?
Well, I'm not
that was where
loaded gun pointed at Bill right now.
That's when you asked about what the normal manure price is.
I think 35 is an industry standard. But just if a guy has a different one than that, that doesn't mean
that he's
screwing you. You know that he's cheating you or not cheating you. It just means you got to do some more math. You have to do another bit of math when you're determining your final point. Well, multiplier thing, that's the one I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole, not in a million years.
To bring us back to the topic, so where do you stand on the trade aspect of, so if I'm getting silage, I'll give you manure back. What's the value there?
Boy, I don't want to get in trouble with any of my customers or whatnot, but I think it's more so, I would totally do it separately. I would say,
sure,
you're buying manure from me and I'm writing you a check for silage and you're going to write me a check or at least we're on paper. We're going to have that on. And, but again, it comes back to if you're in a neighborhood where you struggle for land and struggle for manure acres, maybe that might be part of the deal.
Would you guys agree on wheat straw? That tends to be more of a deal. Like I won't pay you quite as much per ton on wheat straw. You get free manure. To be one that maybe is a little, like, I agree with you on the corn silage one, Bill. That one's a little tougher.
Yeah. They all have their own caveats. But yeah, straw is my favorite. It's like the last bastion of capitalism said that in the movie Trading Places, I think. But that's what I always think of straw.
Like, why is that?
Explain. Because because the years that I would have to buy 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 bales of straw, people would call you up and say, what are you paying for straw? And you tell them. And they would call you a no good, dirty, rotten, cheating son of a blank bastard. And the other half would be like, cool. When can I come? Like, I don't know, anytime. Sundays too? Yeah, usually. Really? When do I get my check? Well, 10 days. Really? How long does it take you to unload? I don't know, 10 minutes. You can unload a semi until, oh man, how much straw can I bring? And they're like, I don't know, until I get the shed full, I need 5,000, 6,000 bales. Oh, this is the best thing ever. And then again, meanwhile, you have the other half that
you're screwing them.
Yep,
because
they have a better market. I didn't take it personally. Like they were willing to do more work to take it to five different places and deal with maybe not getting a check right away or maybe having to, take 10 bales at a time.
Well, and maybe store it, right.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And whereas our option was, Roll your hay wagon with eight bales. I don't care, whatever, and you'll get a check. And yeah, it was pure capitalism. Supply, but yeah.
And the reason I bring it up is I think there are guys out there, and, well, I know there are because I've talked to them, that have that expectation with wheat and with corn silage sometimes because you're taking more nutrient with corn silage than you are with corn grain. Of they almost get mad of like, well, no, you're going to put manure here. Like, I gave you these extra nutrients to feed.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to give me manure back. And so I think there are some guys that have that expectation. So that's why I bring it up is that it's not every scenario, and it's I don't think it's an even trade necessarily from the silage point all the time. I mean, maybe there are times that it is, and I don't want to get in trouble with anyone. Like, I think these deals do happen, but yeah, I think there is that aspect of things of like it gets back to what we've been talking about this whole time is building that relationship, making bridging the gap between the two groups is. Keeping your customer happy sometimes means doing things maybe differently for Joe than you're doing for Dan over here.
Absolutely. I need Joe a whole lot more than I need Dan.
He and I, we know we have.
I know that when the rain starts coming, I know I can go to Dan's field or whatever, Joe's fields.
Yep.
And he's it's going to be okay. And we're going to go drink beer at the end of the day and tell stories about whatever the mud.
Yep.
And I know the other guy. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. But no, these always come down to like the negotiations, the art of the deal, the what is, the business is all about what's your next best alternative. So if you got somebody next door to you that wants to raise 100 acres of corn silage and you can figure out a deal to get them discounted manure or something like that as a caveat, as a carrot to get them to grow silage, add more power to you.
Yep.
I guess that the thing that I see out in the countryside is like, it's this, you have to sell your product. Yeah. That's really what I see out in the countryside is you got to put your salesman hat on. And if you look at the dairies that have really, really grown and really, really built that network around cooperating growers, most of those guys are pretty chill dudes. You know, they're good with people and they're able to go out and talk to the local dude who has a couple hundred acres of crop farm and or cropland and. There's a correlation.
One question keeps brewing in my mind. Who is the manure salesman? Is it the farmer or is it the agronomist?
I'm going to dodge that one very well. I would in our role, I think back in the day, I think it was more the dairyman I was and you were like the tech services guy. Like when I go to sell somebody inoculant and they have a bunch of nerd questions for me that I can't answer, I bring the tech service guy. It's kind of like
the hype man.
I'll put it this way, because I think as farms, that relationship has to be talked about as well. And in general, it's the farmer's product. So they're the ones that should be. I think you answered that perfectly. I never thought of the tech service guy. But yeah, it's hey, if the person selling the product, or in this case, the dairy farmer or hog farmer or whatever farmer, has to make and reach out and establish that relationship, establish that. And then if the person says, I don't know, can I talk to this person about the manure sample or about this? Or lately I've been getting a lot of questions about salts in manure because of the Hefty Boys, or they have a problem out in North Dakota with that. We don't seem to have that. So then I come in or the agronomist can answer those questions.
Yeah.
Where that does get tricky, I've had it where the grain farmer doesn't know. I've had it where he's like, well, I don't know, I called the agronomist. They told me that farm's not going to have enough manure anyway. And I called the farmer and they're like, what do you mean? We'll get you manure. And it's just this of knowing that part to knowing.
Being on the same page.
Yeah, how you're going to sell it, whose product it is to sell. And I do think as a farmer, they're just like, I don't know enough about how to sell it. Either like you're my grandma, so you know how to sell this. Like you go,
you're like
you,
no,
you go sell it. And but what I'm getting is like you're not. That first part is establishing a relationship. Part of it's selling this product. Yes, and I will step in and help with that. But first step is the relationship.
Yeah,
building that even getting out of like what it costs, who's going to pay, well, all that stuff right away. I don't set that for a guy. I don't know their, financial situation.
Sure. You can't be making little deals. Not
right.
Side
right.
deals isn't the right. That's not. No, but, it sounds like it's nefarious. But
correct.
Hey, can you send me my bill? Whatever. Can I prepay or can I? You know. What?
Right.
Yeah, I got three tankers over here.
How much you willing to pay?
So speaking of that, I don't know how much time we have left here, but I have seen a lot of cool arrangements between growers and between cash grain growers and dairies on payment.
Oh yes, correct.
Seen some really creative, cool stuff done where you're kind of prepaying and then postpaying. There's don't discount the creative things you can do, like for either side, for cash flow / tax stuff.
What I want the dairy to think about is currently a grain farmer can sell grain at any day, at any time.
Yep.
They can, okay, that Chicago Board of Trade price or this local co-op price is what I want. I'm going to sell some. So like you say, having those options, and same with fertilizers.
Yep.
Is there can be things done that, okay, I want to lock in this much manure or what similar to what a co-op.
And it sounds really complicated. And it sounds, but you know, get with the same guy that's doing your hedging and whatnot for you, and your financial advising could probably come up with a system that to put that in place where your grower can lock in a price for his manure and his silage on such and such a day, and you can then turn around and protect it.
Sure,
if
right.
You want to, you know, there's I don't know the mechanics and the minutiae of it, but there's a lot of smart people in the world financially that would be able to set that up. And yeah. As well as if memory serves, when I was doing this, the canning factories, they'd pay you like in December or something like that. So, you know, you didn't have any cash coming in for your peas that went off in June for months on end. That can be a real selling point for some guys. Like, oh, I'm going to pay you a little bit ahead.
Right.
I'm going to prepay you. And then, you know, I'm going to pay you out in installments after that. Helps my cash flow, helps your cash flow.
Right, things to help both farms.
Yeah, there's some creative things that can be done. And
yeah.
I'm just waiting for like my next farm call to be like, I can't believe, oh my God, my damn growers are going to call and want me to preach. I can't believe you said that, but whatever. Well,
I would agree though, it can be quite simple at times. Yeah. Even, of you just whatever your, it doesn't have to be this extremely.
No, it does not have to be that
crazy. Yeah. And I don't think both parties don't want it that much red, you know.
Well, yeah, you don't want to complicate it more than you have to. And anytime you can make life easier for yourself and for the other person, that's worth its weight in.
To sum this whole thing up with a bow, I would, you know, go back to what you were just saying, Todd, like go out and build those relationships. Like just go build those relationships. You know, no, you don't need acres today, but does anybody milk fewer cows today than they did 10 years ago? Like, could anybody have imagined some of the sizes and some of the,
right,
how, like, you know, man, go out and build those relationships. Go talk to that guy who's going to retire from farming. Just, it doesn't make you a slime ball to be just to go build a relationship. It doesn't make you, yeah, go talk to that cash grain guy that strip tills. Like, who knows? Maybe, no, whatever. Yeah. Go knock on doors. Go talk to people. It's, yeah.
People,
put your salesman hat on.
People are scary, Bill.
Yeah, then watch Tommy Boy. It's the best salesman movie yes. ever. It is actually the best training for sales there, ever.
Does it have to be your bull?
No. The best one for this is like, I could take a crap in a box and...
Right, I could take a dump in a box.
This is literally...
Slap a warranty on it.
You're taking a dump in a tanker and trying to... Like so that's what...
But the art of that movie or the is like, he just had to figure out how to sell his style, right? Like he had to find his way of communicating and his way of building the relationship.
Instead of mimicking his dad. Yeah.
Instead of trying to mimic his dad.
So he's got to hit him in the side of the head with the board. It's not here.
Not so much here.
And then he'll knock something loose that he gets some wings. But so
that's the same way, you know, whatever your personality is as a dairyman, you got to go out and build these relationships, whatever it is. Then you just got to build your style around that. Like when I go to sales training, I'm like laughed out of the place. Like people... I'm the worst, like technical salesman ever, ever. Like I do everything
by the rule.
Yeah,
like
I'm terrible. But yet I pretty put
up. You found your way.
I have my own sort of Tommy Boy way of selling, and it's served me pretty darn well in life. But it's certainly nothing like when I have to go to the sales training things. It's just I just laugh. You know what I mean? You know when they the corporate sales training. It's like it's beyond the pale of it's whatever.
Richard, what's happening?
Those who can't do teach, and that would be the same. All right, I better stop there.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time with us today. I don't even know how long we've gone, but I'm sure it's been a long
yes
long episode, so hopefully our listeners enjoy.
Oh, hell yes.
Yes, we appreciate you being here. And to play out, we've got a little special exit music for you.
A little 7/8 time signature for you.
You've been living in the limelight, Bill. The question always is, how much of this can we play before we get sued?
It is.
But we appreciate you taking the time, Bill. Thanks for coming out.
Hell yes. Thanks, guys. Always and great.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and happy farming. One must put up barriers to keep oneself intact.